The thin line between sauce and not sauce. Although this book is called Egg, Bacon, Chips and Beans, the real hero is probably sauce. Specifically, in my case, brown sauce. Number one, sauce is good because it's a smelly liquid. It gets flavour to us quickly and powerfully. To quote Len Fisher in How to Dunk a Donut, we often enhance the aromatic appeal of our meals prior to indigestion, by coating them with gravy and sauces. Because of their liquid constituency, these materials release their aromas more readily than do the foods they coat, and provide an enhanced aroma experience and flavour expectation even before the food reaches the mouth. So sauce makes the meal exciting. It creates the expectation. It gets the nose working. All because it's a slimy liquid. Now, I bow to no one in my admiration of the EBC&B, but it definitely needs something to give it a little kick. And that's where the brown sauce comes in. The sauce supplies the astringent, tasty hit of sour. Number two, ketchup just is. Malcolm Gladwell has written a long and fascinating article about ketchup, which points out what a strange substance it is. His key point is that ketchup doesn't work like other foods. Its peculiar combination of ingredients and flavours has to work in just the right way, balancing vinegar, salt, tomato, sweet and sour. Otherwise it doesn't work at all. And that means you can't really create good ketchup varieties, which is why you don't get all the different types like you do with pasta sauce or mustard. Number three, there's a thin line between sauce and not sauce. The above point about ketchup is illustrated when you go to a cafe and get a cheaper brand of sauce served up to you. You notice that they're a little more liquid, a bit more vinegary. They have more bite, but they don't enhance the meal so much. They've crossed the line and become flavoured vinegar or something. Number four, sauce is all about control, as Janet Jackson once almost sang. We like sauce because we can self-medicate. We determine how much we have and where it goes, and of course we use this control to express our personalities. We may be a splurged all over the place person, or a make a pile in the corner person. We may get one big glomp designed to last the whole meal, or we may keep going back for another dose. It's entirely up to us. It's our inalienable right to do this, whatever the bureaucrats in Brussels tell us. Number five, HP sauce and Daddy sauce are owned by Heinz. And that's weird and scary. Shouldn't the EU be worried about this? Yes, Microsoft may have a bit of monopoly with computers, but how could Heinz own it, both HP and Daddy's? That can't be right. Not just because of the potential for holding the nation to ransom by controlling the sauce supply, but because it goes against our folk understanding of how brands work. Because in my little head, and I suspect lots of other people's, it works like this. HP sauce is made by men in bowler hats in the cellars of the Houses of Parliament. The ingredients are obviously all brown, but they're quite posh. Things like church's shoes, hunting dogs, oak trees, cigars, and old copies of the Book of Common Prayer, that kind of thing. Then I imagine an extremely old retainer in a big white wig tests each bottle by reciting Latin incantations over it and glaring at it through a monocle. The bottles are then delivered to stores around the country by the steam train out of Camberwick Green. Daddy sauce, on the other hand, is manufactured in a huge smoky factory in the West Midlands by gnomes and dwarves, who spend their evenings watching the loneliness of the long-distance runner and Saturday night Sunday morning. Daddy's is made from conkers, old boots, bricks, mud and Newcastle brown ale. It's flavoured by being used to wash front steps in the Black Country before being recollected and squirted into bottles by pit ponies and children. They are both, of course, equally delicious, but you can see where I'm getting at. HP is posh, Daddy's is common. They shouldn't come from the same place, because that's the class structure of sauce. Daddy's is working class, ketchup is middle class, HP is upper class. Just like classic class politics, the peasantry and the aristocracy unified against the merchants. And yet, in reality, they're all controlled from some well-appointed Heinz marketing suite somewhere, probably Slough. What a world we live in. Number six. There's something fascinating and alien about those big catering bottles of sauce you sometimes see. They speak of another world. You know the ones. Huge, often dripping with vinegar, which has made the label go all transparent. I like them because they're so strangely alien. They speak of a world that you're never going to see, the world of the cafe cash and carry, the world of catering supplies. I once decided I wanted to visit a cash and carry, so it helped me understand the economics and logistics of cafes. But I didn't. The thing is, I just didn't want to see behind the curtain. I wanted to keep my cash and carry fantasies in place because my vision of these places is fixed and important to me. I see a huge out-of-town shopping development occupied mostly by massive retail sheds, though with an occasional Pizza Hut and bowling arena for light relief. There's an even bigger shed, with even less enticing signage. It has an air of impenetrability, like Fort Knox or Milton Keynes. To get in, you have to show a card you borrowed off your cousin. There are enormous shelves everywhere, stretching way into the distance. It's like an even more massive version of the government storage facility at the end of Indiana Jones. But these shelves aren't carrying secret government files or wardrobes called Nob. They're carrying catering supplies. You're in a world of sauce. Enough ketchup to sink the Titanic. Enough brown sauce to sink the iceberg. Now you can die happy. You must be tough and tireless. The classic cafes of London are marvellous places. They should be preserved like sites of special scientific interest and guarded by force fields and wolves. The seaside cafes, beloved of everyone's youth, must be protected from mega casinos and Latinisation, if necessary through the imposition of a massive punitive tax on soy milk and chocolate sprinkles. I believe all this. I love these places. Yet the places I love most live by the road, and they don't need our help. They're doing very well without interventions from concerned citizens and miserablest journalists. Transport cafes are the guardians of the British cafe tradition because they keep that tradition economically viable. They know their customers and they deliver what they want. Cheap food that fills you up quickly. The opportunity to talk to someone, a waitress, a fellow traveller, someone. The opportunity to be left alone. A paper, a telly, anything so you can tune people out. A decent loo, a big car park. A good truck stop delivers all this, plus all sorts of more specialist requirements like d'oeuvre and pornography. But an excellent truck stop will also deliver particular ambient extras that add a certain piquancy to the experience. Number one, none of the chairs will match. The original chairs were bought at a job lot sometime in the 70s. They were probably destined for a municipal conference facility but got hijacked somehow. They've now been supplemented with chairs from car boot sales, from skips and from dead people. All perfectly serviceable, but unlikely to draw oohs and ahs from the antique roadshow crowd. Two, everything will be geared to keeping costs down. So there won't be big bottles of HP on the tables. Sauce will be strictly rationed via sachets or heavily diluted with industrial vinegar. Number three, despite the rigorous cost control, the portions will be generous. There won't be the skimpiness of your average motorway services. This food has to get you through a long day delivering bulky, heavy stuff. Two little rashers won't cut it. What it means is that when you get to the cafe, you're knackered. You get out of the car with a stiff-legged hobble and stumble to the loo to empty your overfull bladder. The tune you were shouting at the top of your voice to stop yourself falling asleep is churning round and round in your head, preventing you from thinking any kind of coherent thought. Only some kind of cellular memory, buried deep in your genes, gets you to the counter and gets the words full English out of your mouth. You also serve. The five service paradigms and how to cope. British culture is not primarily a service culture. It's a waiting culture. Not waiting as in waiters and waitresses, but as in queuing, standing around, lolling. And a culture of silent complaint. So we're not good at service, not good at giving it, not good at getting it. If the tea takes too long to arrive, we'll tut, crane our necks round to look pointedly into the kitchen, and maybe even glare at the waitress, while desperately trying not to catch her eye. But it'll be ages before we complain. This is a good thing. This is what helps society tick along in a smooth and unembarrassing manner. However, despite this implicit agreement that service won't be great and we won't complain about it, there are times when the service style can be troubling. So here's some handy advice about what to do in the cafe of your choice. Slow. Slow service is rare in cafes. They mostly want you out of there because they want more bums on seats. And it's not like restaurants where the longer they keep you waiting, the more wine you'll drink. But it can happen, especially when they're busy, and when this happens, this best advice is, well, wait. There's not much else you can do, is there? If you make a fuss, you might get your meal slightly quicker, though probably not, but the whole cafe will just think you're an arse. So why bother? Read the paper. Do a crossword. Make a mental list of things that are better than they used to be. Surly. Surliness is part of the theatre of egg, bacon, chips and beans, or théâtre de œuf, jambon, frites et haricots, as the French might have it. So maybe your waitress is a little rude. It's not the end of the world. She's probably had a really rough day. Enjoy it, revel in it. A lot of these people have brought surliness to imaginative new heights. They are Rostropoviches of rudeness, Einsteins of the insult. This could be your chance to be insulted at an Olympic level. And so what if it's just common or garden rudeness? Why ruin your meal? As my nephew would say, take a chill pill, and then take 10p off the tip. Random. So what do you do when you don't get your order? Live with it. Eat it. You might like it. Life is too predictable today anyway. You've got your Sky Plus and your iPod and your digital radio and your phone all giving you exactly what you want whenever you want. It's time you had something you didn't want when you didn't want it. Try something new. Friendly. Brilliant. Just what you're after. Lovely food and a splendid smiley chat with a member of the waiting community. Quick tip though, if you're a bit lonely, and let's face it, lots of people in cafes are a bit lonely, don't assume that a waitress loves you just because she smiles at you. It's an easy mistake to make, and we've all been there. Too friendly. Probably the worst scenario, especially if you're British. What do you do if someone insists on telling you everything about themselves and how it's going and what bastards VAT inspectors are and how Burton Albion got on in the cup? Especially if they combine it with all sorts of assumptions about what you're interested in or what you care about, like because you're reading the paper they'll suddenly ask you who won the 315 at Uttoxeter when you might actually be reading a very trenchant analysis of fin de siècle mores in Patagonian ping pong culture. What to do? Smile thinly. Return to eating. Never go back. Oh, I do like to be. You don't hear much about the sea in modern Britain. You hear about inner cities and urban development and countryside alliances, but you don't hear about the sea. We haven't had a decent cod war for ages, and tankers don't seem to dump oil into the sea with the same regularity they used to. And you definitely don't hear about seafaring. When was the last time you heard Britain described as a seafaring nation? We're not. We're a commuting nation. The sea isn't part of modern life. We fly over it, we don't sail on it much, we don't make a living from it, we don't do paintings of it, and we don't worry about it as a bulwark of national defence. You see what I'm getting at? Feels like we don't think about the sea much these days. Though we still like to be beside the seaside. We still like to be beside the sea. The pull of the bucket and spade, the sand and the shingle, the fish and the chip. Maybe it's the last vestige of our seafaring heritage, our desire to get on a pedalo and drift aimlessly out to sea until the RNLI pluck our bodies, beetroot with exposure from the middle of the Atlantic. And for me, naturally, a huge part of the seaside experience is the seaside cafe, the temple of ice cream and salt, Horlicks and hygienic hardwood chip forks. Some things to think about seaside cafes. 1. They don't all do egg, bacon, chips and beans. The twin drivers of the seaside culinary economy are ice cream and chips. They keep the seaside communities going, and it has to be faced, you don't always fancy a fry up at the seaside. It might be too hot, or you might want a knickerbocker glory, or you might find a bit of bacon reminds you too much of your own skin after you fell asleep and the sun came out unexpectedly. But sometimes, just sometimes, the EBCB is exactly what you're after. Maybe you're enjoying a cold Easter break in Skegness. It's been raining for 3 days, and the kids have exploited all the possibilities of the arcades. You've read every Robert Ludlum for miles around, and you've no idea what to do next. 2. They sell everything. Sunglasses, rock, buckets, spade, little flags, toy cars, replica trawlers, chocolate, fishing nets, ice cream, newspaper, Robert Ludlum books, hats, visors, wristbands, towels, beach bags, plasters, RNLI tea towels, rubber spiders, big things made from shells, little things made from shells, other things made from shells, sun cream, umbrellas, aspirin, anoraks, toy soldiers, wooden spoons featuring local scenes, disposable cameras, egg, bacon, chips and beans. 3. They're always trying to get you outside. Seaside cafes are always in denial about the real seaside experience, rain, misery, tea. So they're always trying to create a Riviera experience, which normally means plastic garden furniture on the pavement next to the car park across from the shopping arcade, which is right next to the sea. So you sit out there, unsure whether you're going to be squinting at the sun or sheltering from the rain. You feel like you'd maybe like to go inside, but you think you'd be letting the side down if you do that. Almost admitting that Canberra is not Cannes and Newbiggin is not Nice, and you wouldn't want to do that. 4. They open when they want to. Seaside opening hours are, to say the least, variable. To start with, you have to deal with the fact that the British seaside has a fragile economy, balanced between our weather and easy jet prices to somewhere warm. So most cafe workers have at least a couple of jobs, and since they only get busy when the tourists arrive, they're often somewhere else when you're battering at the door pointing at your watch. And then you add that indefinable sense of seaside time, that sense that whether you're in Bondi or Bournemouth, seaside places operate with a sort of relaxed hippie sloth. It seems that there's some mysterious connection with the ocean that makes seaside people slightly indolent, by inland standards. Ancient landladies or pierced students, they all have that faintly leathery skin, that mad staring gaze, and that tendency to take forever with your cappuccino. And that's what makes a seaside cafe one of the best places in the world. Brown liquids. The egg, bacon, chips and beans is incomplete without a hot beverage, or more specifically, a brown liquid. I've never really understood that. Why are all our fry-up accompaniments brown? Tea, coffee, Horlicks, Bovril, Ovaltine, all brown. Odd that. Tea versus coffee. The big two are obviously tea and coffee. I'm a 90% tea man. I have to be jolted out of my routine to have a coffee. The camp coffee at the New Piccadilly will do it. Or the possibility of doing a 50s throwback frothy coffee in those lovely brown transparent cups and saucers. But most of the time I'm all about the tea. And most people are like that. They're either a tea person or a coffee person. It's one of those eternal divides, like cats or dogs, Bing or Frank, Socialist Workers' Party or Workers' Revolutionary Party. The values and associations of each are quite clear. Coffee is energetic, foreign, modern and cool. It's about youth and rebellion for hundreds of years, from the first coffee houses acting as centres of radical thought and debate, to Cliff and Tommy Steele meeting in Soho coffee bars to organise the non-violent overthrow of squares through hip gyrations and swearing. Tea is different. Tea is slow, English, traditional, relaxing, reflective, quiet and frankly, a bit dull. You can see why I'm a tea man. Plumbing. The mechanics of beverage production fascinate me. It's one of the first things you notice in a cafe. The vast assemblage of pipes and valves they use to deliver a semi-warm drink to your table. Except on those occasions when they manage to invent a whole new state of matter, something that's still apparently a liquid, but which has the brain-boiling properties of the gases on the surface of the sun. But the thing that fascinates me is the tea urn. You get a taste from an urn which is quite different to the thin, civilised texture of the domestic tea bag and kettle arrangement. Tea urn tea is thick, dark and meaty. You get the sense that there's something in that urn that dates back to the dawn of tea history, that the urn contains some kind of ur tea which flavours every cup the cafe dishes out. The tea essence is like the yeast that brewers strive to preserve, giving the beer its essential quality. I like to imagine that if a cafe ever went up in flames, and it would probably be an insurance job, then the owner would dash back in for the tea, and that years later you'd still be able to taste some of that quality of the fire in the tea. Intellectuals and brown liquids. One of the great romances of the cafe is to sit and pretend to be an intellectual. This requires a coffee, and ideally a cigarette, the stump of a pencil and a slim volume of poetry, or something equally unreadable. You don't actually have to read it, you can read the cafe's copy of The Mirror if you like, but you've got to leave it somewhere conspicuous in case a fellow intellectual wanders by and wants to start a conversation about the death of intimacy in working class social spaces. Coffee seems more suitable for intellectual work because it delivers more caffeine, more of a jolt to the brain. This gives you the sense that you're thinking harder and faster, your thoughts are racing and are therefore better. And since you've obviously been up all night thinking difficult thoughts, you need a coffee to wake you up. And coffee lets you ally yourself with various different schools of caffeinated thought. Number one, the French potentialists, the original espresso elite, Sartre, de Beauvoir, street cafes, Rive Gauche, the geographical feature, not the perfume, Galois, Les Deux Magots, knowing laughter, fierce denunciation, raised eyebrows, large bowls of coffee with delicious pastries, early death. Or the beat elite, the American world of Java and jeans, Ginsberg, Kerouac, Pollock, typewriters, lucky strikes, streams of consciousness, paperbacks and firearms, roadside diners, black coffee and hoagies, early death. Or three, the Soho miserabilists, our homegrown bunch of cafe intellectuals, Farson, Bernard, various Freuds, absolute beginners, little cups of bad cappuccino and desultory plates of scampi, the partisan cafe, collars turned against the rain, woodbine, paperback, penguin paperbacks, demob suits and utility furniture, jazz, formica and bongos, all in black and white. Early death. So grab an intellectual tradition, pop down to the bookshop, pick up a penguin and get to the cafe for a quick 4-hour coffee. Functional food. Let's be realistic. We mostly eat food because we have to. It's primarily not an aesthetic experience, it's a functional one. We're eating for energy. And there's no more functional meal than egg, bacon, chips and beans. Lots of protein, lots of calories. It's gotten people through marathons, hangovers and extended nighttime sorties over Berlin. And time was, this view of food was Britain's gift to the world. Fancy food was something foreigners did, like art and sex and surrendering. We know better. We weren't seduced by foreign... We knew better. We weren't seduced by cookery books and fresh ingredients. But not anymore. Now every perfectly respectable inner-city NCP is desecrated with a farmer's market, and school children are being deprived of their inalienable right to spend their dinner money on chips and curly whirlies. Instead, we should celebrate our uniquely British perspective on food and foodery. What are the two great British gifts to food culture? Easy. Imaginative uses of offal and food you can carry around. Now, it's not my place here today to talk about offal, though I'm from the East Midlands, so I know a bit about it. But I would like to remind people of our noble cultures of portable food. Functional food at its best. Think about the Cornish pasty. Why that peculiar shape? Why that strange pie? For functional reasons, of course. It was designed so Cornish tin miners could stick their lunch in their pocket. Perfect. A delicious pastry case wrapped around some lovely, spiky, meaty stuff. And even more cleverly, that ridge along the back, which is originally much bigger, like the pointy bits of a stegosaurus, were designed so that miners could eat the pastry, then throw that bit away. That way, they didn't have to touch any of the food they were actually going to eat with their tin-stained hands. Talk about biodegradable packaging. And so we get the pork pie and the sausage roll and the scotch egg and the kebab and fish and chips. All designed to be edible on the move without any of that sitting down, appreciating it nonsense. And then there's the ultimate achievement in functional food technology. The sandwich. The genius invention of one of our own noble peers. Not invented in order to advance culinary science or to uncover taste explosions or any fruitified notions like that. No, it was invented so he could stuff his face while continuing to play cards. Let's remember the Earl of Sandwich. Let's celebrate his genius and remember that food doesn't always have to be delicious. Sometimes it just has to be convenient. Frequently asked questions. Since this thing began as a website, I thought I'd do a quick FAQ to finally answer some of many of the questions I get online. Question. Doesn't eating all these fried meals make you fat? Aren't there health concerns? Yes, it does. I am fat. There are health concerns. Or there would be if this was all I ate. On average, I only have a full egg, bacon, chips and beans every other week. Though averages lie. In making this book, I did once have four in a day. What a day. As you'll see if you look at the blog, I did once take a few months off to train for and run a 10K because I was worried about the fat. Now I'm trying to balance the two. I figure that if I run 20k a week, I'm also entitled to an egg, bacon, chips and beans every week. And this plan is really working well at the moment, apart from the running. Question. What's your favourite cafe ever? I'm not going to answer this on the grounds that it might incriminate me. How could I go into my regular cafes when they all might know that they're not my favourite? That wouldn't be right. And anyway, I don't have a favourite. It's like asking a parent who their favourite child is. You can't answer it. You love them all for different reasons. I will say this though, the Hat and Salt Box in Derbyshire does the best chips in the country. Question. Who does the best chips in the country? You're just not listening, are you? Question. How come so many of the cafes you review are in London or the East Midlands? That's a better question, with a slightly longer answer. There's a lot in London for two reasons. Firstly, this is where I live, and therefore mostly where I eat. So a lot of these photos are regular haunts of mine. I'm in Sky 2 almost every day, and the Marketplace Cafe almost as often. I love these places, so they're going to be in the book. Also, it has to be said, London has a very strong culture of interesting and quirky cafes. There's a huge density of really interesting places here, from classic mid-century places with the fascinating decor, to some great 70s throwbacks, to the really characterful working places of yesterday and today. If you want to fill your day with great cafes, you come to London. Why the East Midlands? Partly convenience, partly regional pride. I'm from the East Midlands, Derby actually, and I go back up there a lot. We stay in a place between Ashbourne and Uttoxeter, near the JCB factory. It's more idyllic than it sounds. So we're often filling a wet weekend by visiting another cafe, and we've become very familiar with the transport cafes of the M1 and the A50. But I'm also waging a small war for regional fairness. I'm convinced that the East Midlands doesn't get a fair shake within the national culture. When was the last time you heard an East Midlands accent on the telly? I'll tell you when. When the beloved Brian Clough died, Then you heard the folk of Derby and Nottingham in full cry, but even Brian's unlikely to die twice, so I bet you don't hear them again for a while. Would you even recognise an East Midlands accent if you heard one? So part of that war is an upweighting of East Midlands cafes. And part of it is a downweighting of the most overrated tourist attraction unit in the whole country, the Lake District. Yes, it's quite pretty. Yes, some writers hung out there once. But ask yourself, what has it done for you lately? It's all traffic jams and tea shops, daffodils and whining. It gets on the telly a lot because the establishment all have third homes there, but it's not a patch on the Peak District, and that's why there are no Lake District cafes in here. And it's nothing to do with laziness or not ever finding anywhere I liked. Question. Who was that? What was that film with that cafe in? The one with the bloke in it? You may well be thinking of Quadrophenia. That's got good cafe scenes in it. Or there's the fantastic refreshment room at Milford Junction in Brief Encounter, or the Cardoma, where Celia Johnson and Trevor Howard meet for lunch. The best thing about that place is that it's absolutely stinking thick with cigarette smoke, and yet if you look at the back wall of the restaurant, there's a big sign pointing down some stairs saying, Smoking Room. If it's this smoky in the rest of the place, what must the smoking room be like? You could probably hang on the smoke in there, or walk on it, or use it to insulate your wall cavities. Or there's a good Cabez Cafe in Adventures of a Taxi Driver, one of those 70s British sex comedies with no sex and lots of people who used to be in on the buses. Or there's Michael Caine's version of Alfie. He picks up a bird in a magnificent place called the Busy Bee, with a jukebox and a pinball machine and lovely curtains. Or there's the magnificent Stanley Baker in Hell Drivers, a gritty, bitter tale of British lorry drivers racing around the countryside in horribly unconvincing fast motion. Clashes of manly egos and driving skills all come to a head in a marvellously grim transport cafe, where the relentless theme is miserable utility. You'd just love to be the nervous family gathered at the back of the cafe when they all get into a fight. The food looks to be industrial in quality and quantity. But for me, you can't beat a tiny moment in the splendid Scottish film Gregory's Girl. Remember that? John Gordon Sinclair and a cameo from Claire Grogan. There's a scene of perfect delicacy set in a shopping centre wimpy bar between John Gordon Sinclair's character, a lovelorn teenager, and his little sister, wise before her years. It's full of teenage wistfulness about the British suburbs. This isn't Italy, no style. And the sad content of childhood. What do you dream about? Just ginger beer and ice cream. I'm still a little girl, remember? And then she sums up the cafe experience in one tiny lovely thought. The nicest part is just before you taste it. Question. So what's the appeal of these places anyway? Well, that's the biggie, isn't it? There are a few things. I like the variety of people you get in a good cafe. They attract all kinds of everyone. Working people, filling up, intellectuals being classless, the posh recovering from hangovers. I like the people who own them. It takes energy and ingenuity to keep a modern cafe going. It's not easy, and it takes interesting people. And the people who run cafes are the best argument in the world for unrestricted immigration. Cafe culture was built by immigrants, and they're the people who are keeping it going. It used to be the Italians, now it's the Estonians, the Polish, the Thai, it's everyone. They're the people who are willing to do the hours, scrape by on the money and put up with the drunks, because they know however rough it is owning a cafe, it's a solid business. People will always want fried food. I like the anonymity. You can pop into a cafe, order without making eye contact with anyone, and leave without exchanging a word. You can be lost in your thoughts or hidden behind your paper. You're in the cafe, but you're in your own little world. I like the artificial nostalgia. There's a weird phenomenon in the modern world, that increasing nostalgia many of us feel for something we don't remember in the first place. Steam trains, route masters, Brief Encounter, Bovril at football matches, Pez dispensers. We think of these things fondly, even if we don't remember them. Many cafes evoke this sense very powerfully. I like the randomness. On the surface, cafes are entirely predictable. There's a limited number of chair, table, counter, condiment configurations. The food tends to be in the same culinary ballpark. There's rarely performance art or a string quartet to surprise you. But there's still all this randomness and unpredictability. Cafe owners are masters of their own little domains, and they exercise all their rights with considerable abandon. Just look at the art they put on the walls. It's art you've never seen anywhere else. Art you can't begin to understand. Art you can't help staring at. I like being out of the house. Not because being in the house is bad, but because leaving the house gives you a small sense of achievement. In Seinfeld, George explains why I want to watch a video at Jerry's place rather than at home. Because if I watch a video at my apartment, I feel like I'm not doing anything. If I watch it here, I'm out of the house. I'm doing something. Cafes do the same thing. You have a cup of coffee at home, you're an idler. You have one in a cafe, you might be a revolutionary poet. I like the food. I like egg, bacon, chips and beans. Looking back, it's so bizarre. When I was at school, I never imagined I'd write a book, particularly one about fried food and cafes, especially one that quoted Level 42 lyrics in the chapter headings. And yet I just have. And this is the last bit, the bit where I wrap everything up in nice concluding thoughts and send you to bed thinking happy thoughts, resolving to eat more fried food and to do more exercise to compensate. So what have I learned? 1. Cafes are great because they change, not because they stay the same. There's nothing like the pleasure of an old 50s throwback cafe, the formica, the brown glass coffee cups, the decrepitude, the peeling air of miserabilism. I love those places. But I know their end is inevitable because that's part of their charm. We can and should preserve many of the fixtures and fittings, but we can't preserve the atmosphere because a great cafe is also a great business, not a museum. And great businesses change and move on and evolve. Great cafes die every week. It's a huge shame, but it's the reality of small business life. And you can't blame people like Starbucks. It's not their fault. They're not really even in the same business. But for every great cafe that dies, a new one is born. And realising that and discovering the new ones is one of life's huge pleasures. And of course, the best cafes just go on and on, updating themselves just enough, adding new little ideas on top of the old ones, accruing layers of change which create their uniqueness. And that's lovely. 2. Great British cafes depend upon a regular flow of the non-British. Cafes are built on immigration. Enterprising foreigners are often the only people willing to do the hours, and often they're the customers too, especially at 6 in the morning. Cafe cultures are built on their labour and their love, and cafe food is built from the melding of our traditional stodge with their imported cuisine. Once it was the Greeks and Italians, now it's people from Eastern Europe, from Thailand, from everywhere. These are the people who preserve the Great British Cafe. 3. Writing in numbered points is much easier than trying to sustain any kind of logical narrative thrust using paragraphs and that. I'm surprised Dickens wouldn't knock that out. 4. Fry-ups are delicious. I know it's pathetic, but after all this thinking and writing, that's the best I can come up with. They're just delicious. They fill you up, cheer you up, and make you feel like life's worth living. We should all spend more time in cafes eating fry-ups. That's it. Thank you.